Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 32, Confessions of a Double Weaver. This episode, we had the pleasure of talking with Paul O'Connor, who is a noted artist working in the form of double weave. He's written several books on the subject, including Loom Control Double Weave from the Notebooks of a Double Weaver and More Loom Control Double Weave. So we'll be talking with him just a bit later on. I've got an update on my new loom. And then finally, we end things up with an essay from weaver Laura Fry, who talks about overcoming challenges. I apologize if I sound a little froggy today. I have the tail end of a cold, but the show must go on. I'm sitting here recording on a fine September day, and I am just awash with excitement because about a half hour ago, my loom arrived. There was a bit of drama associated with getting my loom into my house. The driver gets to the turnoff from my road, and he is driving a big tractor trailer. And I live on a dirt road, a little tiny twisty dirt road. So the driver was not certain whether his truck could make it up the hill. I've been waiting for this loom for so long. The thought that my loom was less than a mile away, but might have to go all the way back to Seattle for a smaller truck, was driving me nuts. So we agreed that I would come pick up the driver in my little car and drive him up and down the road, and he could decide if he thinks his truck can make it. So we're doing this, and we get to the end of the road, and I run into one of my neighbors, Dossie. And I stopped to exchange pleasantries with Dossie because I had borrowed a table from him, and I wanted to make sure he was getting it back. And in the process of this conversation, I explained who the guy sitting next to me in my car was and that we were trying to figure out if his truck could make it down the road. And I asked Dossie for his opinion because he's lived on the road a lot longer than I have. And living at the end of the road, he sees a lot of the people trying to turn around. Well, it turns out that I am lucky in my friends. Dossie had a flatbed truck that could easily handle the 587-pound shipment. Dossie said no problem. He hopped in his truck, drove it down to where the big freight truck was, got my loom on it, drove to my house, we unloaded it, and it is sitting right behind me at the moment, 11 boxes of loomy goodness. I think it's some indication of how much I love you that I am sitting here recording this so you can have a podcast instead of jumping to the back of the studio and tearing apart these boxes. So if you've ever doubted my commitment to Weavecast, now you know. I'm going to be documenting the loom raising of putting together my new loom on my blog, WeaveGeek. If you've been looking at WeaveGeek recently, you've seen some of the preparations I've done, fixing up my baby wolf, tearing apart my studio to make space for this big 48-inch wide loom. It's not a big studio. It'll be kind of interesting to see how everything goes together. So like I said, if you want to see pictures of that, the place to look for the personal side of what I'm doing is WeaveGeek. It's www.weavegeek.com. GEEK.com. And there'll be a link to that, of course, as always, on the show notes. I just want to thank my neighbor Dossie, even though I'm pretty sure he doesn't listen to this show, and tell him how much I really appreciate his helping me out. He is so getting a new rug for his house once I get these 11 boxes put together. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn. They produce a wonderful assortment of hand-painted yarns in luxury fibers and recently came out with some 60 over 2 hand-painted silk that I saw at Convergence and which is just stunning. You can find them on the web at www.justouryarn.com. One of the unique joys of doing Weavecast is getting to sit down with weavers who I have long admired from their books and videos and getting to talk to them about their work. I discovered Paul's book, Loom Control Double Weave from the Notebooks of a Double Weaver, at my local yarn store and kind of brought it home on a whim because I was interested in double weave. And at first glance, it's kind of a humble volume. It's got a certain Kinko's aesthetic to it, but it is an absolute treasure. As I read it, I realized that packed inside of it were just descriptions of double weave I hadn't seen anywhere else. And it opened my eyes to the possibilities. It was one of those eureka moments reading this book. Pound for pound, it's got some of the clearest and most comprehensible descriptions of how double weave works that I've seen anywhere. It's one of the treasures of my library. So, when I was at the Complex Weavers Seminar, I heard that Paul O'Connor was there, and I was delighted when he agreed to do an interview. And we actually talked for about an hour and a half. A fascinating man. In the middle of the conversation, he would just casually mention, for example, that he had once worked on the Manhattan Project. I ended up having to cut out a lot of the non-weaving information because I wanted to keep the focus for Weavecast on weaving. But if you ever get a chance to talk with him at a conference, go for it, because the man just has some wonderful stories to tell. Paul started out his career as a chemistry teacher, but a health problem took his career in a completely different direction. Chemistry's loss became weaving's gain. If you have a copy of Paul's book, Loom Control Double Weave, you might want to go grab it because some of the things we're about to talk about are pictured in that book. If you don't have a copy of the book, go up to Paul's website, and there is a link to that in the show notes. On the website, you'll be able to see pictures of Ganesha as well as the women of Rajasthan. I'm here with Paul O'Connor at Complex Weavers, and he has graciously made time out of his schedule to talk with us.
I'd like to start by talking about how my wife spent one night learning to weave. Early in our married life, my wife enrolled in a weaving program in St. Paul, Minnesota, with a close friend of hers. We had two children. One 3 years old, the other 1 year old. This seemed like an opportunity for my wife Pat to get away from my kids for an evening. About 3 hours later, she came home. I put the kids to bed and all the rest of it. And she said, "Well, that's enough of that." And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, there were eight of us, and we spent 3 hours pulling little strings through little holes, and we didn't say a word. And what I need is good adult conversation." And the next day she joined the League of Women Voters, and the rest is history. I was an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. I was invited to go to India to supervise the high school and college teachers who went from the U.S. to India to assist the Indian professors in introducing chem study. I would go to India for 2 years, and then I'd be back at the university for a year, and then I'd get invited to go back to India for another 2 years, and so on. As I began to work more and more at the secondary level with the secondary teachers, my interests shifted away from research and towards teaching. Probably around 1969 or 70, I developed the voice problem. This is when I had such difficulty initiating speech. I essentially made the decision to leave the university at that time. 5 years later, I learned of an operation that released that problem. paralyzing one vocal cord and so on. But by that time, I was really out of date scientifically. I had also begun my interest in weaving. A fair amount of that was inspired probably by what we were seeing in India, very rich history and tradition in textiles, weaving, and the rest of it. During the time I was back in the U.S., I began to take courses in weaving out of curiosity. How does a relatively simple machine, the loom, allow one to weave such intricate patterns and so on? First weaving course I took was a night school class at the YMCA. And we took the looms out of a closet and set them up. And we did one step, folded the looms and put them back, brought them out the next week, did the next step. And I ended up weaving one placemat. And the teacher was very amused because there was one error on the back side, which I couldn't see while I was weaving. We went back to India, and I took a small loom with me. We were going to be staying for 2 years. My wife was also going to do some projects in India. Our daughter was in high school over there. Housing was provided. We had servants, and they were somewhat mystified by a man with a loom and a woman knitting and doing a real rug and so on, because these are very low caste sorts of things. Handling sheep, wool, and so on is a no-no. And it was during this period of time that I began to develop a real interest in weaving. In one of those interludes, for example, I took floor loom one at the Minnesota Weavers Guild from a wonderful, wonderful teacher, and then I took floor loom two. In that program, there were perhaps 6 or 8 looms with different projects on them. We were allowed to come in at any time that we wanted to use these. And this is when I was on disability from the university. And so I spent a lot of time. The Weaver's Guild was within walking distance of our house. And the last project that I tried was double weave. And I was just flabbergasted as the warps in the weft could be transformed from the top layer to the bottom layer and so on and so on. About the same time, while visiting my wife's family in Southern California, we saw a wonderful exhibition by an Israeli artist named Agam, A-G-A-M, whose father was an Orthodox rabbi in Israel. The only way that he could accept the fact that his son had become an artist was that, as a painter and sculptor, he was making kinetic art that invited viewers by walking around. The viewer was seeing changes in whatever it was that he was looking at. And his father, the rabbi, could accept that because only Yahweh can make a permanent, perfect image. The kind of thing that I became interested in weaving. This is a double weave on 4 shafts. And this is one layer and the other layer is behind. And then the layers are interchanged. And in this piece, these are all different colors, shaded gradation, and all of these sides are dark black. And as you walk by, the image changes and so on.
Yeah, it's a series of, looks like squares, square colors?
Yeah, they're wooden square dowels inserted in the opening. Here the dowels are actually plastic, but you can see the layer interchange. And then it's a question of choosing colors so that one has a different image as you walk by and so on. And gradually, these kinds of things really began to interest me tremendously.
Really?
This is actually the first double weave I made when I came back from India. I had wanted to weave an elephant's head, because as you may know, there is an Indian god, Ganesha. Out of wisdom, academics, you know, perfect. All of the techniques of double weave are involved in this. And to try and explain the warp, which was made of rope, jute, sisal, cotton, whatever we could come up with, was divided into sections. And so you would weave a double weave thing, and you would widen them, and then finally, at this section, the entire warp is being woven essentially in a tubular form. And having done that for a while, we're supposed to go out in the other direction. Cut it off the loom, do something with all the ends, and then arrange it. My wife helped me stuff the central tube with newspapers, and then we flung these things around over a yoke that came from India, and all of a sudden, there was the elephant's head.
Yeah, it looks very much like an elephant.
This was back in the days when everybody was doing big, fuzzy, organic things. There's an absolutely wonderful, wonderful weaving by K. Sekimachi, whose parents were born in Japan, but she was born in the U.S. Here are examples of some of her weavings.
Oh, right, the little folding out books.
Yeah. There was a book published in 1975 by Jack Leonard Larson and Mildred Constantine, and it was about the new weaving, presenting it as an art form rather than just a craft. And I saw this and I thought, oh wow. And I also saw this by Richard Landis. These are the opposite sides of the same weaving.
And this is flat color work in double weave.
It requires 8 shafts. And I think of this as a window design. And the back of it, I think of it as a plaid. I learned that Richard Landis was using sewing thread, and I thought, I began to use sewing thread because I could go down to Minnesota Fabrics. You know, I could buy spools of thread, and the color choice was fantastic. I, again, wanted to build on my experience in India. This is what I think of as the first real double weave that I did. Ganesha was, I mean, kind of an accident. And I was slowly but surely beginning to understand what was going on in double weave. I call this the women of Rajasthan because the colors are the colors worn by the women of rural India. This is the back side of it. The window design was the side I was looking at while I was weaving. And when I took it off the loom, I got this.
It's beautiful.
Wow. And you get 2 weavings. And so I realized that many double weaves have distinct differences between the top layer and the bottom layer, which you don't see as weaving.
What's causing the color blending here in the center? Is that a double weave color blending, or are you using different shades of yarn?
Well, this is again an HF weaving. One of the webs is in the top layer, the bottom layer, the top layer, the bottom layer, and so on. And meantime, the warps in these 2 columns are lighter in color, and then become darker as they move out. So it's possible to get if you choose the warp and weft colors carefully, a gradation of color that gives you this sort of bright spot. By this time, I had joined the Weavers Guild, and I began to teach weaving. In essence, I began a second career, which in many ways was quite similar to my earlier academic career. You know, I taught, I did research, and trying to understand all this stuff. I presented workshops, I wrote books, publisher perish, the old academic traditions. Slowly but surely, I began to understand aspects of weaving that I did not understand. Block weaving, this again is a double weave, a very short section of a very long piece. And this requires 16 shafts, but I can choose the height of the blocks. These are all the same height. These are all the same height, and you can get these differences and so on and so forth.
How many layers of warp are you dealing with in this piece?
These are always just two layers. There are four colors in the warp and an unlimited choice of colors in the weft. I was changing the colors of both the backgrounds and of the individual designs depending on the choice of the warps and wefts. I took a color theory course from a good friend of mine at the University of Minnesota. And instead of doing what most of the students did in the course, namely to paint colors, each week I would weave something that was based on whatever it was we were trying to learn. So gradually I built up my background, and this book came out in 1992. And by the time I had the operation and my voice came back, I began to give seminars and workshops at Convergence and all around the country and the rest of it. I think the most amusing thing that ever happened to me was when I gave a seminar at Convergence in Washington, D.C. in 1992. Because the word went out on the internet, a young woman apparently drove all night to get to Washington. She got to the seminar, she was dead tired. She's going to be in my seminar. And she sat way over against the wall because she thought, well, if I fall asleep, then I can lean against the wall. And so in I came. I was introduced as an ex-chemistry teacher. And she thought, oh my God, I hated chemistry. And I started off in this gravelly voice, and she thought, I'm trapped. I can't get out. And she was writing to a friend on the internet, and somebody told me about this. And she said that I began to talk, and it was the most wonderful seminar she'd ever heard. And one nice thing about the career change was that nobody knew what I talked like before, and it's never made any particular difference. I noticed the difference in my voice.
It's like me, I had jaw surgery, and I think I look very different afterwards, and I'm somewhat disappointed, but people who didn't know me before, you know, they have no idea.
You look great to me.
Yeah, you know, your voice sounds great to me.
Well,
I'm curious, you've done both sculptural and color blending double weave. Do you find them equally interesting, or is one kind of swaying you more now?
I really started on things based on Richard Landis' style of weaving and the kinds of things that he did in block double weave. He spent his entire career with an HF loom. I jumped beyond him, moving to a 16-shaft loom, and this was a weaving that I did. You need a 16-shaft loom to do this. The background of this particular piece is pure Landis HF loom. But here I'm doing sculptural pieces that came out of the case of Camacci influence. And
So you've got color blocks on the in the background, and then on the foreground, you've got little pleated.
In essence, this is the sort of thing that I would do separately and attach to a background.
Right. For folks who are not getting to see this, you can look at the color insert in your book, Loom Controlled Double Weave, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yeah. I would work in phases. Isa Comanche's work, that very lacy one done with monofilament, involves crossing and recrossing of layers and then very carefully pulling it up so that it draped into that wonderful form. Her work always was so careful in terms of the finishing techniques, and I learned a lot from her that way. This weaving, which is one that I'm so well known for, is pure Isa Comanche.
And it's kind of a pleated fan thing with multiple layers interchanging. Really cool. And I love the color gradation.
She had much more art training and so on in her background, and did forms either with photo transfer images and so on. I'm much more geometric. I'm satisfied by much simpler images, shall we say. But this one is different because each of these is a double width. I'm weaving like this, and I'm weaving four of those. 1, 2, 3, 4. And you need 16 shafts to do that. And she has limited, most of her work is 8 shafts or less. But now what I do, well, I dyed the linen in this. What I did was, this is the closed woven edge, so, and this edge is open. And so I inserted a piece of buckram, which is heavily starched linen, in order to give this some rigidity, and then I sewed up this open edge. It can take a variety of forms. For example, this is the same weaving.
Oh, and it's just been rearranged into a flower, kind of chrysanthemum pattern.
Yeah. And you can see how I've been crossing layers. I very carefully charted this out, of course, before I started.
It seems like something like that would be nerve-wracking to weave. I get into enough trouble just trying to do two layers and make sure I don't cross threads. Did you have some special way for checking that while you were weaving it?
The biggest trouble, because it required 4 shuttles, was to keep them in the proper order. And my loom has a bench, which is attached, and it's open over here, and I'm sitting sort of at the edge of it. And I had the 4 shuttles next to me. And so I would pick up this shuttle, and I would go over and back, and then I would lay it back down. And I'd pick up the next one, the next one, the next one. And then when I reached the point where I wanted to cross these, I rearranged these. And then I could do the next section. And then I would rearrange them, and I could do the next section. And I discovered that I could weave these in between layers. For example, at the start or the finish. And at the beginning, I am carrying 2 of these layers in between these 2 layers. These 2 layers. And now I bring these out at different points. And the only way not to get a real tangled mess was to have the shuttles in order so I could pick one up and not get tangled with any of the others. I just loved doing this. It was challenging, but I liked it. I had ended a seminar that Alice Line gave in Washington at Convergence this book had just come out. I thought I knew everything about double weave. And she was talking about network drafting. And she had some examples in double weave. And I thought, I've just written the book. And I don't really understand what was going on. And for the next 4 years, I worked on that off and on. There was a period where I went away and spent a lot of time on a different topic, but I kept coming back. And I finally found the words that helped me understand what was going on. In network drafting, you can have a transition in the threading and or a transition in the threading order. All of a sudden, I understood everything about network drafting. And I wrote a book on network drafting for double weave, which is actually on my website. It's an example of how, when I finally got it, I can teach it to you. And that was a wonderful experience for me. I have found as much satisfaction in what I have done in weaving as I did in my first career as a chemistry. And I realized that the educational aspects of both of them are very similar. If I understand something, I can teach it to you. And if you learn it, I'm really very, very pleased. I've had some wonderful experiences at this complex weaving meet. There's a young gal from Montana who discovered my web page, and I have on that web page the detailed instructions that I gave in my workshops. And she went through all of them, and they all worked, and she was delighted, and she wanted me to know. I mean, there's a lot of satisfaction in that. Most ambitious double weave project, I think it has been what Margaret Coe and I have been working on together for the last 2 years. It's the CD that is being introduced at this meeting. The title of this CD is A Tale of Two Tie-Ups and How They Grew. And when most people are introduced to double weave, they're told there are two basic tie-ups. And here they are, in diagrams like that. And this one will weave this layer on the top and this on the bottom, and the other tie-up will do this. And of course you can interchange and connect them and so on. Well, it turns out that if you have four colors in a warp, you have six different warp color pairs. And any one of those color pairs can be on the top, and then it's complementary, one will be down here. And as a consequence of that, there aren't just two basic types, there are actually 12. While I was trying to figure out what network drafting was like, I took the typical 4x4 grid of a type and I divided it into fours. And this was the one that we used black on top and white on bottom, and this is the one that we used white on top and black on bottom. And I interchanged all of those quarters. That gave me 14 new tie-ups. But none of those tie-ups gave two separate layers. They gave integrated double weaves. And if you put those 14 different tie-ups together with all the other tie-ups that derive, you end up with 196 different checkerboard designs. And one day, it suddenly dawned on me that if you look at the two basic tie-ups, there's never a tie-up in these two positions. There's always a tie-up in these. Now, what that means is that I have a choice in these positions where I could have a tie-up or not have a tie-up. If I start off and add one tie-up at a time, then two, three, four, five, and so on, I end up with 2^8 tie-ups that are in this family based on those two original diagrams. So now I've got 256 tie-ups. And that's what this CD is about. There aren't really 256 different woven designs because there are a number of duplications. So there are approximately 64 different woven designs that come out of those 256 different types. And this is the magnum opus. I don't expect to mine any more types. You also asked, what are you working on currently? I think you know that my wife died suddenly last year, and this has meant quite a change for me. In trying to bring a little order to my condominium, I've been going through a variety of things and discovered that in her knitting projects and in her basketry projects and so on, she had been using her own hand-spun yarns. And there was always a little bit left over. And so I thought, I'm going to use her yarns in my double weave. It'll be very satisfying for personal reasons. And it's a new aspect of double weave that may be of interest to other people and so on. So far, I haven't been successful, but I have run across very exciting things. And I'm learning, well, it's sort of the way Peter Collingwood was talking about. You try something that doesn't quite work, and you think about it for a little while, and you work it out. And this is sort of the tradition of science that I've come from. These are two examples of how I'm using the hand-spun that Pat had used in her work. This is one that I just did on a very narrow warp, and I really like the way this stands up over the background. This is my typical sewing thread background, and I've added two extra warps, and I need two more shafts to do that. So this warp and this warp are on the same shaft, and this one is on a different shaft. And I'm using them to tie these down. If I tried to weave them in the body of this, the whole thing would go smash. So they're sort of sitting above. Let me explain this one to you.
This is cool.
What I was trying to do was essentially a circle, which is not easy to weave. And I wanted to create these channels. I was working on a warp that was already on the loom. There are things about this that I personally don't like, and I put a new warp on the loom. And one is how I can handle these tie-down threads so they aren't visible. Well, the obvious way to do that is to have them the same color as this.
But then they'll show up in the ground cloth, unless you put them to the back.
No, if I put them at the back, which I tried, it actually distorts this back fabric, and I don't like the way it hangs. So the solution, when they're not tying down, they're floating between the two layers.
Oh.
So, and they aren't creating that tension problem. I worked out all the details, but I'm sure I'm going to.
That's what I love about double weave, is that there are all these sneaky little tricks you can do that seem like magic when you look at the finished piece.
Yes, that's a good way of describing it. It may be in terms of color, it may be in terms of this kind of an effect. When you compare a single layer of weaving, you've got all the warps and wefts. There they are. And they may be wonderful, and you may love the piece, but you can't do a trick like this. That's one of the things that attracted me to double weave. What I'm trying to do here is to combine different sizes of fibers, and that always creates a problem. My solution that I am still working towards is to allow these large fibers to float on top of the very fine fibers of the background. obviously they don't promote. I have to do something. And what I have come up with is tying them down, attaching them to the background every once in a while, which means that they are free to seem to float above the background.
I'm also curious about these beads. Were those from India?
These?
Yeah, the things on the end.
A couple of years ago, I began to weave real beads into my weaving. And the story on that is that Pat was a member of a knitting group in Tucson, and they worked on knitting beads into a shawl. And that was a very arduous labor of love. It took her 4 months to one shawl with a lot of beads in it. Really very lovely. But anyway, I thought, I ought to be able to do a faster job of weaving beads into a double weave. The only reason for the double weave is that the beads were on a separate short length of weft, and I thought of it as a substitute weft. Instead of throwing my second shuttle, I laid in this strand that had the proper number of beads and the proper color order, and I could weave the ends into the bottom layer and hold everything in place. Okay, in going through things that had squirreled away, I found a necklace with these beads, and there was a note on this necklace, so there must have been 20 or so of these beads. Pat made these.
Oh, wow.
That's what I thought. I'd never seen them before. I know that she did a little work in ceramics with a friend of hers who taught at McAllister, but she never showed them to me. And I think they're wonderful beads.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They look almost like little seed pods.
As I was working on this, I'd also discovered these. I just did this as a thought. The trouble is that I can't weave these into that background because as you weave, you roll things under the breast beam, and these are pretty big, clunky things, right? So they're there just to remind me, think a little more carefully, Paul, about how you might attach these after the weaving comes off the loom.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and so much of your knowledge through your wonderful books.
Thank you.
All that talk about living in India makes me want to travel there. How about you? This is Air India by Electric Buddha.
The Beatles took a trip down to India. Met up with Ravi, he plays a mean sitar. Got themselves a gig at the Rishikesh. Ashram loved the Maharishi's guests. Air India keeps calling. Take your seats for a new man. self-deception taken mighty high.
Next up, we have Laura Fry, who is a production weaver living in Canada and a very talented lady. She's got a wonderfully informative website. If you haven't seen that before, give it a look. It's up on the show notes. And she talks about weaving through some of the difficult things that life throws you.
A few years ago, I was asked to talk to a guild about what it was like to be a weaver as a profession. After the presentation, one of the audience commented how impressed she was that I had redefined myself as a professional weaver several times over during my then 25-year career. I now find that I am redefining myself once again, this time as a weaver with genetic coronary artery disease. Now that the procedure that saved my life has been done, I am left with the new reality of my physical self, one that requires medication to continue to function. One of the medications is a beta blocker, which prevents my heart rate from increasing. The effect this has had on my ability to weave as I used to has been profound. As I come to grips with the fact that I can no longer weave as I am used to, it's a little difficult to earn much money when you can only weave for a few minutes at a time. It is also frustrating to feel so disabled. I'm used to weaving at a rhythm of 45 picks per minute for 45 to 60 minutes at a time. To have to stop weaving after 10 minutes hardly seems worth my while to begin. On the other hand, I can still weave. Like the butterfly which sheds its chrysalis, I must shed my old way of thinking about weaving and how I weave. I am learning to be grateful for those 10 to 15 minute periods instead of feeling frustrated. I am looking at weave structures that I previously avoided because they were too slow for production. I am learning to stop regretting what I no longer have and focus on what I do have, what strengths have been left to me when the physical reality changed so dramatically this spring. I am also hoping that as the medication deals with my condition, I will be able to reduce the amount of medication required and weave for longer periods of time. But if that doesn't happen, the two shuttle weaves, which are slower just because of using two shuttles, will no doubt allow for longer weaving sessions. When I discovered I was a weaver at the age of 25, I had plans to weave as a production weaver for 25 years, then teach for 25 years. What actually happened was that I wove and taught for 33 years. What the coming years will hold, I don't know. But this much I do know. that one way or another, I'll be weaving.
Your friends, when they tell you you're gone too far, it's hard to make it all alone. Everybody needs a number they can dial on the telephone. We all need someone who cares. Sometimes in life, you'll feel like you're falling through the cracks. You've got to get back up and start again. Sometimes your sanity can get strained just from living, but a friend can help you deal with the pain. Of surprises, not always good. Circumstance can take us for a ride. Maybe the hard things bring out who we really are, like a pottery wheel and the clay. Sometimes in life, you feel like you're falling through the cracks. You gotta get back up and start again. Sometimes your sanity can get strained just from living, but a friend can help you deal with the pain. All right. Your friends, when they tell you you're going too far, it's hard to make it all alone. Everybody needs a number we can dial on the telephone. We all need someone who cares. All right, yeah.
Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, we'd like to thank Charlotte and the Francis Irwin Handweavers of New Jersey. Thank you for your support. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarns, and they provide a wonderful assortment of hand-painted yarns in luxury fibers. You can find out more about them and their wares on the web at www.justouryarns.com. Our musical guests this episode are Beeple Brox with Lost But Not Forgotten, Electro Buddha with their song Air India, and the Fabulous Hats with their song Start Again. I thank all of these artists for sharing their talent on the PodSafe Music Network.
I can go put together my loom.